This is Take Care, a health and wellness show produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Jason Smith.
And I'm Catherine Loper.
Ladies and gentlemen, now that the weather is warmer, you folks will soon be getting outdoors to exercise and build yourselves up.
We're sitting right now in the WRVO studios recording this program, and many of you may be sitting right now too, possibly in your car, maybe at work. Many of us spend much of the day sitting.
And sometimes that's necessary, but other times we could be making a better choice, a choice to be more active. And what about when you get home from work? Do you take the dog for a walk or relax on the couch watching TV?
That's what we're going to talk more about today, staying active. Not just being active, but staying that way, even as our lives change. Many of us have aged out of an organized phys ed class, but there are still things we can be doing to keep moving.
We'll talk to a few experts today. One will help us understand why common injuries happen and how to avoid them, especially useful when some of the newest and most popular exercises can be fairly intense in nature. Later in the show, we'll hear more about our society's focus on fitness. Exercise seems to gain and lose popularity at times as our thoughts on what it means to be fit evolve.
Everybody who knows you says you're becoming somewhat chubby yourself.
Me? That's ridiculous. For the past dozen years, my weight has always been 160 pounds.
Oh, yeah? Well, I'll bet you weigh a lot more than 160 pounds right now.
Don, I'll prove to you that you're wrong. Now, follow me. I have some scales in the bathroom. We'll see just how much I do weigh. All right, I'm on it, Don.
Yeah, and look what it says, 169 pounds.
Say, it does say that. Can't understand how I gained so much. Oh, I know what the extra 9 pounds is. No, I left my wallet in my other pants.
From cycling classes and beer leagues to triathlons and aerial yoga, there's something for everyone in the 21st century. But first, how active are we?
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention publishes data on whether adults and adolescents meet physical activity guidelines. For more on how we shape up and the trend of physical activity over time, we're joined by Dr. John Omura of the CDC. Omura works in the Physical Activity and Health Branch of the Division of Nutrition, Physical Activity, and Obesity. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Omura.
Thanks for having me.
A lot has been made about how sedentary Americans are these days, but what does the CDC's latest data tell us about how active we are?
So in terms of the physical activity levels of Americans, we can describe it by both adults and adolescents. So for adults, just over half, or 54%, are doing enough aerobic physical activity to meet the aerobic physical activity guidelines. And what's encouraging is that this level has been increasing over the past decade. So in 2008, that level was around 44%. It increased by around 1% a year to around 54% in 2017. For adolescents, our data is a little bit more intermittent. But for teenagers, we know that around 1 in 4, or around 26%, are getting enough physical activity to meet the aerobic guideline. And over the past decade, we really haven't seen much of a change in this level.
So why should we care about these activity levels? Why is being more active important to overall health?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question. That's really our whole mission and vision here where I work. Really, being physically active is one of the most important things that people of all ages can do to improve their health. Being physically active imparts numerous health benefits. It helps foster normal growth and development. It can make people feel better and function better and sleep better. And importantly, it reduces the risk of a large number of chronic diseases. So for example, things like type 2 diabetes, heart disease, stroke, hypertension, a number of cancers, and even depression.
And what qualifies as being active? I'm sure that means a lot of different things to different people, but what do you mean to reach those benefits to overall health?
That's a very important question. When we talk about being active, probably the easiest way to think about things is in reference to the physical activity guidelines for Americans. Just last year, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services released the second edition of those physical activity guidelines, and it's helpful to really break it down into specific age groups. There's three age groups that are listed in the physical activity guidelines for Americans. That includes preschool age children, so that's ages 3 through 5 years, as well as children and adolescents, which is 6 to 17 years. And then the general adult population, so which is adults 18 years or older. Just briefly, I'll describe what the guidelines are for each of those age groups. So for preschool age children, the guidelines say that those children should be physically active essentially throughout the day. For children and adolescents, so again, this is 6 to 17-year-olds, the guidelines say that those children and adolescents should do 60 minutes or 1 hour or more of moderate to vigorous physical activity a day. And that's really in terms of aerobic physical activity. And that 60 minutes could be moderate on every day, but there should be a vigorous component at least 3 days a week. And then they should also be doing both muscle strengthening and bone strengthening activities 3 days or more a week. And then for adults 18 years or older, there was a new component to the guidelines that were released last year, and that is that adults should move more and sit less throughout the day. And this is really important. It gets back to what you were talking about in terms of sedentary behavior. So the message here is that some physical activity is better than none, and that adults who really sit less and do any amount of physical activity gain some health benefits. And then in terms of aerobic activity, there are some threshold numbers that adults should aspire to achieve. So for substantial health benefits, adults should do at least 150 minutes to 300 minutes of moderate intensity aerobic activity, or 75 minutes to 150 minutes of vigorous activity, or an equivalent combination of the two throughout the week. And then they should also be doing muscle strengthening activity on 2 or more days a week.
I notice it doesn't break down into, say, senior citizens, but perhaps these new guidelines even show that just, you know, getting up and being less sedentary may be helpful, even if you can't be very aerobic.
Absolutely. One of the main messages from the guidelines is that any activity is helpful for health. So moving more in any amount is better than not moving at all.
One thing I'm curious about is the statistics you mentioned at the top shows that adults seem to be more active than adolescents, and I'm wondering if that's a new trend.
It's hard to compare to older data because of changes in our surveillance systems, but we do see that ongoing trend of adults increasing slowly over time, and children and adolescents, or it's really our data for that age group is really among adolescents. It's really stable or plateaued in that age group. And so we are both encouraged for the adults, but continuing to try and achieve progress for all age groups across the country to help them all get more physically active.
It's interesting because I think many adults think, you know, once you get out of school and you're no longer required to be in gym or PE class, that, you know, you really have to think about being active purposefully. And so that's interesting that adults seem to be able to be doing that.
Absolutely, yes. And really those transitions across the lifespan are really important for us to think about in terms of how we continue to encourage people to be active as they transition into different stages of life. And so, for example, even in the physical activity guidelines, there are mentions of specific populations that you're kind of alluding to. For example, recommendations for older adults, as well as for women during pregnancy. So during these sort of unique periods in the lifespan, where we try to target information to those populations to help them start or maintain an active lifestyle.
What kind of things are Americans doing to keep that active lifestyle? And do you see any sort of differences between age groups or regional groups, rural versus urban, that kind of thing?
Really, the most common form of aerobic physical activity in the United States is walking. And we're really encouraged by that because walking is a great way to start and maintain an active lifestyle. It's easy. There's really few barriers to getting involved in walking. So for example, if you think about just walking to work or walking to your grocery store or your local convenience store, it's just an easy way to integrate physical activity into your day-to-day routines as opposed to having to set aside specific time to, say, exercise. So we're really encouraged by that, and we try to encourage communities to promote walking through a number of various mechanisms for their residents. We just released a study actually looking at physical activity levels between urban and rural residents across the country. And we do see that in both urban and rural Americans, the physical activity levels are showing similar trends of increasing, but rural residents certainly get lower levels of physical activity than urban.
Do you think that's just because there is less walking in sort of downtown areas when you live in the country?
Absolutely. That's probably one key component to it. Likely a number of various mechanisms that are influencing those differences that we're seeing, but certainly the built environment, which is really just the way that your neighborhood or community is designed and built, is a major influence there. And then there are also differences by education level, socioeconomic status, age group, those types of factors which may also differentiate the urban and rural communities.
Now, you mentioned walking, and the concept of getting more steps is popular currently and has been for the last few years because of fitness trackers. Full disclosure, I have one and measure my steps probably a little bit too obsessively. But how have you seen that recent phenomenon affect things for good or for bad?
Great question. We're really excited about steps and the use of technology in general. Technology, which can include things like wearable devices that count steps, like pedometers or activity trackers, as well as cell phones. I'm sure many of us have them in our pockets right now, and we're speaking on one right now. They're really ubiquitous, and the technology piece has really been shown to be effective at helping people become more active. Most studies show that people who use a device, as part of a study at least, will get about 2,000 more steps than those who do not. So they are helpful and effective at increasing physical activity, at least through walking. The one thing to keep in mind is that typically devices don't work by themselves. They need to be paired with some other behavior change strategies, such as goal setting, to help them really be effective. Things like, aspiring to a certain number of steps per day, or a challenge, for example. A lot of people will enter challenges with their friends and family to see who can get more steps, or just closing those rings. There's lots of different ways to set those goals, but really the technology needs to be paired with some sort of behavior change mechanism to help them be effective.
And fitness trackers are sort of the latest trend we're in right now, but whether it's, jazzercise or aerobics or CrossFit, we've seen a lot of fitness and activity trends come and go. Do you see spikes when they come and go?
That's a difficult question to answer based on our surveillance systems, because we are really monitoring levels at the national level. Our data sets are probably not refined enough to see those small level ticks, if you will. But that said, it probably is one of the components that's influencing the increasing trends overall that we're seeing over time. So as people are increasingly recognizing the importance of physical activity, and incorporating it into their day-to-day lives, whether that be through specific types of physical activity that you mentioned, or through technology, or through just their day-to-day activities like walking. It's hard for us to determine which of those has the greatest impact, but they are all certainly playing a role in seeing or informing that increasing trend that we're seeing.
It sounds like you and the CDC and other groups are really trying to encourage activity. And if you could just, explain why that is so important and why you think it is important for government and other groups to promote activity in our culture.
The evidence shows that physical activity really is one of the most important things that people can do to improve their health. It imparts numerous health benefits to any individual once they start becoming more physically active. And the CDC is certainly engaged in many efforts to try and promote physical activity across the country for all Americans. For example, CDC recently launched an initiative called Active People, Healthy Nation. This is an initiative to get 27 million more Americans to be more active by 2027. And it's really a multi-sector initiative that promotes the Physical Activity Guidelines for Americans, the second edition that we talked about, as well as some effective strategies that are recommended by the Community Preventive Services Task Force to improve physical activity. And so through Active People Healthy Nation, CDC is working with a variety of partners at the local, state, and national level, as well as other federal agencies and national organizations, to implement really a comprehensive approach to improving physical activity in the United States.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm going to get up out of this chair after this interview and go get some steps.
That's great. I will too.
Dr. John Omura works in the Division of Nutrition, Physical Activity, and Obesity at the CDC. Links to the latest CDC data on physical activity can be found at wrvo.org. This time around, we're covering what it means to stay active, how we can keep up and keep healthy. I'm Catherine Loper.
And I'm Jason Smith.
Okay, now as I count, bend down and touch the floor.
Okay.
Okay.
One, two, three, four. Bend down and touch the floor.
Have you ever heard someone say they have to get in shape before they sign up for a gym membership?
Plenty of times.
Now, historically, what people mean when they say that is that they don't look good enough for the gym, which seems silly, especially when the point is to get fit. But there may be something there.
What if there are exercises available that can help you stay active? Consider them basics to keep you injury-free. It's not easy to jump into an exercise routine, and sometimes inexperience is to blame for initial injuries and related issues.
Joining us now is Dr. Pablo Costa, an associate professor in the Department of Kinesiology in the College of Health and Human Development at Cal State Fullerton. He's also chair of the National Strength and Conditioning Association Research Committee. Dr. Costa, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, I'm happy to be here.
What are some of the more common injuries associated with exercise?
I would have to say, I guess, of course, it depends on what kind of exercise, but regular exercise, not counting sports, non-contact type of activity, I would say probably overuse injuries, your sprains and strains, a lot of times just from doing the same exercise over and over again, and sometimes also actually doing it incorrectly. So I would say that's the most common with typical exercise.
What about with people who tend to be more athletic? I would assume that there is a difference between people who are just doing regular exercise and people who are doing more of like athletic activity.
Yeah, so each sport will have its own kind of more common injuries. Across the board, the most common injury seems to be hamstring strains. So that's in general. But of course, if you look at individual sports and whether they're contact sports or non-contact sports, then they're going to be different. So for example, soccer players are going to have more ankle and knee injuries. Volleyball players, swimmers, they're more likely to have shoulder injuries, elbow injuries. Same thing with baseball players. And if you go into sports that are more, contact-based, even more so, such as football and martial arts type of sports, then you get into the concussions and perhaps fractures. So it really depends on the sport itself.
How does age impact the rate or the severity of injuries associated with exercise?
The severity is a good question. I'm not aware of data for that specifically, but it does, because if you think about it, as individuals get older, they're also kind of decreasing the intensity of the activity. But what does happen, though, is that they definitely take longer to heal compared to somebody who is younger.
There are a lot of people who say that they might not have time to exercise during the week, so they'll try to get all of their exercise in during the weekend. Is there more of a risk of injury in doing it that way, doing more exercise in a short period of time?
It depends. So like most questions asked regarding exercise. So you do have options, for example, high intensity interval training, so HIIT training, a higher intensity, shorter time frame, but you do that consistently, right? So that doesn't appear to be, have serious health consequences. So you can conceivably do a higher intensity, shorter time frame, but as long as you keep it consistent, the problem is the lack of consistency. The biggest issue that we have typically is going to be, as individuals get older, is going to be the individuals who seldomly exercise. So their risk of having a myocardial infarct or a heart attack, that's going to increase in those individuals that don't exercise frequently. And then the more you exercise, then that risk decreases, right? So kind of two different things there. If you don't have time, you can engage, for example, in resistance training once a week, even once every 2 weeks, worst case scenario. Aerobic exercise, do something for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, three times a week, if you're talking about cardio. But again, the individual you're going to have the highest risk, or, more severe risk of actual infarct, a heart attack, is going to be those individuals that never exercise, and then they'll go and do something, once in a month. Because one, they have the risk from the activity, but they're at the same time, it's not consistent enough for them to have like beneficial effects in terms of their health. But yes, there are alternatives. So if somebody doesn't have a lot of time, the idea is to keep that consistent.
There are exercises that are more extreme than others, things like running marathons or that high intensity interval training you were talking about, or these Tough Mudder races where people run, a 5K or more over difficult terrain. The high intensity interval training we were talking about, it's sort of this combination of aerobic exercise and weightlifting done at a maximum capacity. Now, do these types of exercises tend to result in more injuries, or is it just kind of depend on the person who's doing it?
Yeah, I think it depends more on the person. I wouldn't say they're more like a greater risk of injury from what I have seen, both in research and just empirical data. I haven't seen them to be more, you know, a greater risk of injury. But it would be ultimately depending on the person. So a lot of it is just who the individuals are attracted to those activities. And then you're looking at a whole range of activities there that you mentioned. So like marathon would be very long distance. So just a lot of mileage added to your body in terms of your knee joint, your hips, your ankles. So you start getting, you know, those are perhaps, especially with women, shin splints. For just as an example, if you're talking about HIIT training, that could be various different ways. So HIIT training doesn't necessarily have to be involving resistance training and cardio. So you could just do it, for example, on the cardio. So the idea of interval is that you're alternating high intensity with low intensity, right? So you could do that on a bike at the gym and not do anything else. But yes, what you mentioned is traditionally what people perceive as HIIT training, where you, when you are, in fact, doing a combination of resistance training type of exercise and or aerobic type of exercise. But the key thing there is just to make sure that your form is correct and the person is also have a foundation of their fitness level before kind of jumping into a very strenuous activity.
Now, before we get into how to avoid getting an exercise-related injury, let's talk about recovering from one. Now, obviously, you don't want to keep exercising if you've injured yourself, but is there anything in particular that you can do to recover from an injury? We know that, you know, ice and rest, that kind of thing, but is there anything else that somebody who's hurt themselves can do to recover?
It's hard for a layperson to really know their body that well if they haven't been training, but as a general tip, if you have muscle soreness in the belly, in the middle of the muscle, and that's sore, that you're probably okay unless it's just extreme. Now, if you start seeing some more or feeling some more acute pains in your joint, that's when you really want to go see a physician and check that out. But assuming that a serious injury has been ruled out, then yes, icing initially is going to be helpful. But after that initial period, then icing at that point is only going to take the pain away. So after that period that inflammation sets in, you have to take time and make sure that you're always warming up, maybe decrease the intensity of the activity. But that very first step is you have to make sure that you don't have an actual serious injury. But if you do have something that's kind of nagging but not very serious, then ice initially, and then you might actually transition to more heat pads. Some injuries you want to keep icing, others you want to actually use a heat pad and warm it up. So it's a bit difficult to know without knowing exactly what the injury is. But the person, as a general rule, they can kind of try to see if they can feel and whether it's more acute, more around the joint area versus in the middle of the muscle, more like muscle soreness related. And then as always, if they feel severe, if it's a lot of pain, they should see a physician.
We talked about how as you get older, you might be a little more prone to injuring yourself. Does the same work for recovery? I mean, I just kind of crossed that threshold where I just turned 40 this year. So there are days where I wake up and I feel like everything hurts. As you get older, does it take longer to recover from an exercise-related injury?
Oh, absolutely. And congratulations. I'm 39, so I'm looking forward to that next year. But yeah, definitely. So, you know, that's what research shows, but also at a personal level, you know, I can attest to the same thing. When you're young, you train hard in the evening, you train, you know, twice a day and you wake up and you're recovered. Unless you have an injury, you're feeling great in the morning. Now, there are certain types of training that I would do that I would wake up in the morning like that, just very sore the next day. So it does take longer. As I mentioned before, just with your exercise itself, your exercise routine, it might take longer. And if you do have an ache or something like that, it might take longer for that to improve. And in fact, if you are actually talking about older adults, so individuals above the age of 65 and beyond, they might actually need more time even from exercise to exercise, just for their body to adapt for the purposes of balance. So at the gym, they might actually need time even between exercises for them to make sure that their balance is recovered and they can adapt to the next exercise they're doing. So even within the workout, they might need more time than a younger person who can jump from like a squat to a bench press type of thing.
So let's talk about some of the things that we can do to avoid hurting ourselves while exercising. You know, for years, we were always told that you should do things like stretch before your exercise, but that's not really true, is it? You could do some damage if you stretch before exercising, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That is one of my main areas of research. Over and over again, studies have shown that especially static stretching when done before an exercise, you see a decrease in strength, decrease in power, decrease in muscle endurance. So a lot of different performance-related variables are decreased. You have a negative effect after stretching, like when you stretch immediately before an activity. So going back to what I mentioned before, if a tissue is weaker, it's probably more likely to get injured. So we have done studies where we've shown that you might actually increase your risk of injury after stretching. So that might be a new thing somewhat in the general public, but it's something that we've talked a lot about at conferences, and there's a lot of research done on that topic. So the number one thing you need to do would be a warm-up. A warm-up is very helpful to increase temperature, get your body used to doing that exercise, have that gradual increase in intensity that we mentioned before. Depending on what kind of exercise you're doing, you have to warm up what we call a specific warm-up. So if you're running, you can start walking at a more brisk intensity and then start jogging lightly and increased intensity that way, just as an example. And then with resistance training, you could do the same exercise that you're going to be starting off with, but do it at, let's say, 50% of the weight that you're planning on using, and then go up to maybe 80% of the weight. So gradually build up to the weight that you're going to be doing at first, and then kind of try to do something similar for our other activities as well. And then stretching is important, but you want to do that after the activity is done. You still have the improvements in flexibility. You still have those health benefits. That flexibility is extremely important, but you're not going to see the negative consequences from stretching done before the exercise.
When we are warming up and when we're stretching, should we focus on certain parts of the body more than others, or does it just depend on the exercise that you're doing?
Yeah, I would say depends on the exercise that you're doing. So for the warm-up specifically, when we do training studies, we try to warm up what we're actually going to be using. I know back in the days, you would see a lot of, for example, somebody's going to train their chest, upper body, and they're going to do a bench press, and you would see somebody on the cycle ergometer on a bike for 10, 15 minutes. So that's not going to be helping your shoulders, your triceps, your chest that much. So when we actually do studies, we do a specific warm-up to the activity. Whether it's even sprinting or jumping, resistance training is kind of the example I used before, and I used the example of running. So you want to warm up the muscles specifically that you're going to be using, and the joints as well. With stretching, if you do it afterwards, if you want to stretch the whole body, that's fine, because again, the activity is already done. Let's say you are somebody who does train consistently every day or 5 days a week or so, you can maybe just stretch the joints and the muscles that you use that day. So that's just up to the person, depending on what kind of training they're doing. So at that point, it depends on basically what their desire is, because you're doing it afterwards, so it's not going to affect the activity at that point anymore. But for the warm-up, for sure you want to, at the very least, warm up the joints and the muscles that are going to be used.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
That was Dr. Pablo Costa, an associate professor in the Department of Kinesiology and the College of Health and Human Development at Cal State Fullerton. You're listening to Take Care. I'm Jason Smith.
And I'm Catherine Loper. Thanks for joining us. Hopefully while you're on a walk or at the gym.
We're talking about staying active on the show today. So far, we've covered details on guidelines and the reality of how physically active we are now compared to 50 years ago, plus how to prevent injury, whether you're a seasoned veteran of the gym or a newcomer.
We're shifting our focus for just a minute to hear how older adults are staying active. As America ages, more studies are being done on how activity can help reduce the impact of illness or chronic disease. As Ellen Abbott reports, both physical and mental exercise is a kind of medicine for the elderly.
90-year-old John Murray lives with his wife in a senior living community near Syracuse, New York. On any given Monday, he takes part in four different programs.
At least one of them is water aerobics. And another is another physical. A third is a Tai Chi type of operation. And the fourth would be a bind twister, so that they're constantly asking questions and you're constantly giving answers.
Lisa Sonneborn of Clarity Clinical Research in Syracuse says activity like this can go a long way towards keeping older individuals as healthy as possible. Sonneborn's research firm focuses specifically on brain health. She says there are eight pillars or habits that affect the brain, among them exercising, both the body and the mind.
Every time you're moving and your heart is pumping, you are pumping oxygenated blood to your brain. So not only are you helping your muscles, but you're helping your brain too. It's all one system.
Sonneborn says research recommends 20 minutes of exercise 3 times a week for seniors, and it can be modified to suit an individual's own abilities, anything from walking to something like chair yoga. As far as mental exercise, Sonneborn says trying new things is the best way to build strength in the neural pathways.
Trying tasks with a hand that you're not necessarily as good with. So if you're right-handed, try a task with your left. It just stimulates your brain in different ways. So reading books in topics you're not familiar with, maybe trying to learn little bits of a new language.
Murray says he has more time for activities like this now, and he finds most of his fellow residents are happy to try something.
Many of us realize that we have progressed. We have gone over a high point in our lives, and we're in a different class. But we have wisdom, we think. We know what love is all about, I hope. And we still want to grow.
I'm Ellen Abbott for Take Care.
You can find this story and other interviews from today's show online at WRVO.org.
Catherine, I'm thinking of signing up for a color run or maybe one of those Tough Mudders.
I'm not entirely sure what those are, but they sound like fun.
I could do one of those six-legged races with a dog, but I don't have a dog, and it's in the fall. I wanted to do one of those orchard runs, too. Can I use this 10-miler training program I found online for a 15K, you think? Maybe I should just stick to walking.
There's also a wine glass marathon coming up in the fall. That sounds like my speed. But when it comes to exercise, there are a lot of options these days. And it's not just the proliferation of runs of all distances in every city in the United States. There are exercise classes, some inspired by dance or ballet. Others have a more social aspect to them.
Well, whichever you choose, you're taking part in what seems to be a new focus on fitness. Health and wellness is popular for a reason. Generally speaking, more people seem to care about their overall mental and physical health these days. But has that always been the case? Joining us now is Dr. Len Kravitz, a professor of exercise science and coordinator of exercise science at the University of New Mexico. Dr. Kravitz, thanks for joining us today.
It's fabulous to be with you.
You've written about the history of fitness. When did exercising, either for fun or for physical fitness, when did it become popular?
Oh, the popularity of fitness really had a surge in the 1970s when Kenneth Cooper presented the concept of aerobics. And as you recall, that was a time when, you know, fitness was around, but we never had a central component. And Dr. Cooper of the Cooper Institute in Dallas, Texas, presented some magnificent research that he had done, you know, with the military initially, showing how beneficial aerobics was. And he really coined the term aerobics. And that was the 1970s. And then it had a second really big surge in the 1980s, where we had, you know, the era of Jane Fonda and her tremendous video exercise impact. And along with that came a tremendous interest in fashion for fitness. That was really, really the big surges that we've seen, you know, in the last 50 years in fitness.
I can picture the tights and the leg warmers in my head right now when seeing commercials for those aerobics videos being sold. Before the 1970s, did anybody exercise for fun? I mean, you know, and I'm thinking way back before the 1970s, is there a record of people doing exercise just to get into better physical condition? I mean, it's hard to imagine someone, say, in the 1800s just going for a jog because they felt like it.
Well, wonderful, wonderful question. And if we just move back a little bit, the concept of fitness was really more sport, where people competed. As you know, the Olympics are 2,400 years old. So people were doing exercise, but it was really the competitive, the recreational component really began. And you know, I think we can trace it, you know, about a couple hundred years ago with just lifting, and not weights as you and I know it, but lifting objects, you know, like rocks, trees and, you know, limbs and trees, where people were developing muscularity, you know. And along the way, we see that the genesis of resistance training guided our industry, you know, when you talk, you know, over 100 years ago, much more than that cardiovascular aerobics that Kenneth Cooper presented in the 70s. But it was so different, you know, the type that they were doing was so different, but it had that musculoskeletal, let's develop the human body. And that led, as you well know, into, you know, bodybuilding, the sport of bodybuilding.
I remember seeing some of those old movies from the 1950s of somebody strapped to a device with a belt wrapped around them, and the belt shook, and that was supposed to be a way to have a flat stomach. Obviously, it kind of turned out to be a bit of a gimmick, but I'm wondering, how has exercising changed over time?
Without a doubt, technology. And you actually reference a period before we you know, jump too far, where that was when Jack LaLanne made his entrance. And of course, Jack LaLanne was all about, you know, the calisthenics, the weight, and the cardio all combined. And, you know, he was a chiropractor, so he tried to demystify some of those like products. I remember that product too, you know, that belt that would just swivel really fast and it would hopefully whittle your waist, which it didn't. And technology, with the accompaniment of science, like for instance, you know, I consult to a number of companies and a lot of them present ideas to me and want to know the scientific merit. Well, the growth of the exercise industry was when these, you know, innovators and product developers started working with, you know, scientists alongside them with their research and product development, taking us to a whole new level of evidence-based type of exercise products. And today, you know, you go into any fitness facility, you're seeing, you know, we have just surged in our technological aspects of any type of exercise, whether it be selectorized equipment or even different types of free weights, where we really understand, you know, what's best for the body.
There are so many different ways to exercise now. You know, you've got the aerobic exercise. You've got the exercise that more is geared toward building muscle. Is there one or more ways that tend to be the most popular forms of exercise today?
When you say the most popular form of exercise, you know, you're without a doubt hitting two mainstream peaks. And that's anything that is body weight or resistance training, and then anything that is aerobics. And both of them have pretty big categories. You know, the resistance training is for musculoskeletal health, aesthetics, or for, you know, a competition, powerlifting, Olympic lifting. And the aerobics as well has a sport component, but a lot of people just really enjoy group exercise, which has been around, you know, since, you know, even before the Cooper came, you know, we had, you know, very, very, you know, Jackie Swanson introduced aerobics, you know, slightly before Cooper, where it was group exercise to music, and it had a really neat, fun, likable, enjoyable type of interest that attracted many people more for the fun and a little bit less for the health, but it drove, you know, the interest. And those really are two major areas that we even see today, 2019.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care. We're talking with Dr. Len Kravitz, a professor of exercise science at the University of New Mexico. And of course, we're talking about exercise. In terms of popularity, which kinds of exercise tend to be the most beneficial for your body? I mean, you talked about aerobic exercise and resistance training. What's the most beneficial, or is it all beneficial?
Oh, that's a really great question. Without a doubt, if I could start with the cardiovascular, one of the reasons I wrote my new high-intensity interval training book, Hit Your Limit, is there's so much new research now with HIIT training, which is bouts of a higher or harder intensity alternating with bouts of a lighter or a moderate intensity. And so it's, we think of it as an intermittent type of approach to exercise. But the research is so wonderful. Essentially, if I could capstone it for you, it's wonderful for health, cardiovascular disease prevention, and for fat loss. And the reason that type of training is so popular now is you can do it in almost 50% less time than a traditional steady state type of exercise. And time right now seems to be critical for everyone. With the resistance training, it's just so popular from a standpoint of musculoskeletal health. Musculoskeletal benefits now are realizing, you know, the heart as well, not just the skeletal system. And people seem to really enjoy, you know, the combination of both of them. And those are the people that are really the exercisers. You know, we have quite a few people, 30% of our population are, you know, total couch potatoes. They do nothing. And 50% of our population don't even meet the basic requirements, you know, by the, you know, our physical activity guidelines.
We were talking about the popularity of aerobics classes when they came to popularity back in the 1970s. And today we have it seems like one of the big things to do is the high intensity interval training. Maybe it's something like CrossFit or something like that.
The CrossFit, and there's several different variations of those programs. You know, in every city you go to, they have, you know, their high intensity. Sometimes you'll hear the name extreme exercise. You know, it's a higher intensity. And that there is a big part of our population that really loves the challenge. Well, what I really try to, you know, endorse is that you challenge yourself at your own level to make it health beneficial for you. So in other words, a great HIIT class would be a class where we could have elderly individuals, middle-aged individuals, sedentary individuals, all of them changing the intensity of the exercise relative to their fitness level. And those are the best and healthiest class approaches where everybody's going at their own fitness level.
And when you think of the level of popularity of some of these, like going back to the aerobics classes and the popularity of things like CrossFit today, when, you know, if you were to kind of look into your crystal ball and look 20, 30 years down the road, will we see these newer types of exercise like CrossFit? Will they be kind of looked at as fads, or do you think many of them will stick because of how beneficial they are?
It's a fabulous question. If we look at it retrospectively and then think prospectively, group exercise has always been with us. You know, Jackie Sorensen aerobics, Judy Missip jazzercise, Zumba has had a strong presence, all of the CrossFit and variations. We seem to really be evolving, but the research shows that a good 80% of the people who exercise like doing it with other people. There's a social phenomenon when you're in a class with other people. And you and I are going to see, if we look prospectively 30 years, there's going to be an evolution in exercise. I'm not the best one to predict it, but we will see that in 30 years, Group X will be with us. But it will be another form. It'll be another name. And you know, there will be a very, very, you know, strong following with it.
And we also, one of the things that we also have to remember is that the health and wellness industry, it is just that. It is an industry. Gyms and fitness classes and programs are still looking to make a profit. So what do you think that means for the consumer? Is it best for the consumer to pay a monthly fee to join a gym, or is it easy enough to do exercise on your own without paying anything?
It's another fabulous question. You know, fortunately in our society, you know, we have all levels of fitness clubs from easy entry, which are less expensive, to some really high-end, offer a number of amenities besides classes. And then every city has recreational departments where the fitness classes are either free or a very nominal fee. And the way I like to, you know, summarize this concept of exercise to pay or not to pay is, choose what's best for you. Because, you know, like in Albuquerque, especially for seniors, we have these wonderful, wonderful senior centers that really cater, you know, to that population. And those are wonderful for them. But for the middle-aged adult, the rec centers aren't necessarily fulfilling the need, but the private industry really has captured that market. So, you know, you and I will see a little diversity as we, you know, peek around the country, you know, as far as what's offered, and then the pricing structure will follow.
We talked a little bit about how the technology aspect of fitness and exercise, and I'm wondering how has technology changed the way we exercise? I mean, you know, everybody can put a fitness tracker on your wrist and it'll monitor everything. We have Bluetooth scales. How has technology changed how we exercise?
Well, all about awareness. And what's so interesting, you know, we found this out with pedometers almost 20 years ago. People love ways of tracking what they're doing. Pedometers are those really simple devices you put in your pocket or wear in your belt that would just count steps. And people were just glued to their pedometer to see how many steps they could do. And as you said, now we have incredible technology that pretty much monitor anything, you know, that you want from a, you know, health standpoint, clinical standpoint, or fun standpoint. But we seem to be affixed with this awareness that I can track my heart rate, I can track my workouts, I can track my calories, and it drives a lot of us. Now, that's not true for everyone, but it drives a lot of us, like me. I want to always step more every day. I want to step more, you know, to beat my step record. So it's an interesting phenomenon that many of us are really definitely part of that technological creation of glued to technology with our fitness.
And it sounds like this technology, this increase in technology and in fitness is largely positive. As you said, it allows us to maintain that accountability. If you don't hit your step goal today, maybe you'll do more steps tomorrow. But do you think there's a negative aspect to this, all of this new technology in exercise?
You know, it's a great question. You know, I'm looking at the 2019 most popular trends. Number one is wearable technology, you know, the heart rate monitors, the workout trackers, calorie trackers, you know, all the different devices. If there is a negative component, it's that we as fitness professional, me and my industry, where what I'm a part of, we need to vocally and in our presence always talk about the greatest benefit of exercise is the health benefits. They're just are innumerable benefits, you know, from the biggest killer in our society, cardiovascular disease. So my message is we better, you know, really keep pushing our messaging that you are moving more, you're affixed to your wearable technology, but it's all about one major thing. You are improving your quality of life and hopefully, you know, that the quantity of years of quality life.
Do you see anything on the horizon that from a technology standpoint that goes beyond the wearables, the fitness trackers, anything beyond, say, the Fitbit or the Apple Watch that you might see people using to track their fitness in the next, say, decade?
You know, that's looking into the magic crystal ball. What I see without a doubt is these new devices, and I think many of them are there right now. I think, you know, the Apple Watch is there. You'll be able to plug in so much data, and they'll have such a database that what's going to, you know, outcome. And I do believe some of them, Garmin, you know, Apple Watch is there. They're going to be able to really give you an exercise prescription that's individualized, where normally you would have to come see me, you know, or a personal trainer who's qualified to do the assessment. But the technology is going to be so proficient that it's going to be able to monitor several different, you know, biosigns and then say, this is a perfect starting place for you. This is a perfect exercise design for you. You know, these are, you know, strong considerations. So I see that being the next evolution without a doubt.
Is there any indication that exercise is becoming more of a part of people's lives today than it was, say, over the last couple of decades? And what I mean by that is, are more people exercising, or is it just that some people are exercising more?
You just hit it. Some people are exercising more. We still have this incredible challenge. When I've studied it, because exercise adherence has always been an interest of mine, it seems we're really good at getting people started in exercise, and then at least 50% of people drop out after 6 months. And the people that are you know, maintaining and driving, you know, this fitness industry, it's less than 10%. But these are the people that do it all the time, twice a day, you know, multiple times a week. It's much smaller of the big population. And all we have to think about is right now in the United States, 68% of the United States adults over 18 are overweight or obese. You know, and a big part of the obesity challenge right now is physical inactivity.
Thank you very much for your time today.
It's been fabulous being with you. Thank you so much for all your wonderful questions.
Dr. Len Kravitz is a professor of exercise science at the University of New Mexico and the author of the new book called Hit Your Limit.
If you have comments, questions, or suggestions about today's show or anything else, get in touch with us. Email takecare@wrvo.org or find us on social media. This episode and others are available online at wrvo.org and on iTunes.
Take Care is a health and wellness show produced by WRVO Public Media. Our team of hosts, producers, and engineers includes me, Jason Smith, Catherine Loper, Mark Lavonier, and Leah Landry. Mark also wrote and performed the theme music you hear throughout today's show.
Support for Take Care comes from the Health Foundation for Western and Central New York. I'm Catherine Loper.
And I'm Jason Smith. Thanks for being with us for Take Care.